This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
On today's program, a German pensioner has been working for decades in Berlin to remove extremist stickers and graffiti. And now filmmakers are showcasing her as a hero.
They have no superpowers. They are simple persons. So maybe the only things that different them from the other is the fact that they act.
And how people in Gaza struggle due to restrictions on the transport of commercial goods.
Because we can't export, unemployment increases, along with the poverty rate. That makes people suffer.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. We're taking you to Gaza first today. A few days ago, Greece banned all ships headed for Gaza from leaving its ports, and authorities arrested activists on a ship belonging to a pro-Palestinian flotilla. The international activists manning the boats wanted to break the Israeli blockade on the Palestinians. For years, the restrictions on the transport of commercial goods into Palestinian territories has been causing many problems for the people living there. When Egypt finally opened its border with Gaza in late May, many Palestinians had high hopes that their isolation would be lifted. However, as correspondent Rhys Ehrlich reports from Gaza, the reality has been far different.
Farmer Ahmed Shafi walks through his fields located just a kilometer from the Israeli border. From nearby fields, Palestinian militants sometimes fire homemade rockets into Israel. As long as such attacks continue, Israel says it will severely restrict imports and exports into Gaza. Israel uses the sanctions as a means to pressure Hamas, the governing party in Gaza. Shafi calls this collective punishment. The 74-year-old grizzled patriarch says he can't export strawberries or other crops like he used to. As head of an agricultural co-op, he periodically meets with Israeli officials. He describes one conversation he had with them.
They said, we punish Hamas, not you. He said, no, you punish all of us, not only Hamas. Why did you vote for Hamas?
Now, you didn't vote for Hamas, right?
Yes, right.
Israel began its economic blockade of Gaza in 2006 with the cooperation of Hosni Mubarak's government in Egypt. But then, in late May of this year, the new Egyptian government changed policies and permanently opened the border at Rafah Gate. Shafi had hoped the opening would help soften the effects of the Israeli blockade. However, his family and other Gazans still can't get building supplies or certain medicine. Shafi was disappointed because only people, not commerce, can cross the border.
Yeah, for sure it will help the Palestinians in Gaza in general because it will be the gate to the outside world, but not economically. Yeah, economically, is not that much, but for other aspects of life will be very useful for us.
But it turns out the economics of opening Rafah Gate get complicated. Abu Omar lowers a rope into a 20-meter deep tunnel entrance. He operates a tunnel that used to bring smuggled consumer goods from Egypt to Gaza.
We're down to operating about 1 to 2 shipments a month. We used to operate every day. Now people bring their own goods across through Rafah Gate.
But other goods still remain scarce. Gaza Economy Minister Ala al-Rafati says Palestinians have been unable to export most products or get raw materials for their factories.
Even before the siege, Israel imposed many restrictions on our exports. We always had to work through specific Israeli exporting companies, which controlled everything, including prices. Before the siege, we had $250 million in exports of flowers and strawberries. Now all of our exports total less than $2 million per year.
As a result, says al-Rafati, Gazan unemployment stands at 45%.
Because we can't export, unemployment increases, along with the poverty rate. That makes people suffer.
Israeli officials argue that opening the Egyptian border to normal trade would facilitate arms smuggling. So far, they have succeeded in pressuring the Egyptian government to prohibit such commerce. Back at his farm near the Israeli border, Ahmed Shafi wants a normal life for his extended family of 25 people. Regular trade with Israel and Egypt, he says, would help everyone. He wants to see peace between the two peoples, and that includes an end to rocket and mortar attacks on Israel.
Yeah, sure. It caused a lot of troubles for us as farmers, and we strongly fight this and refuse this action, launching rockets on Israel.
Why?
This corrupts the relationship between Israel and us. Life stops. Give them a peaceful life, and we have peaceful life.
Shafi says both sides will have to recognize the right of the other to exist as an independent nation.
We are neighbors, and we are on the same land. We have the right to live, you and us. Yeah.
Shafi says ending the economic sanctions on Gaza would be a good first step towards peace, but Israel shows no signs of lifting the blockade. And it appears likely that trade will be banned at Rafah Gate, at least until a new Egyptian government takes power after parliamentary elections this September. For Radio Deutsche Welle, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Gaza City.
While children and young people in industrialized nations normally attend school and play during their leisure time, many of their fellow youth in developing countries spend their time working rather than playing. The International Labour Organization estimates that some 200 million children between the ages of 5 and 14 work as labourers worldwide. Deutsche Welle reporter John Kanyunyu visited a mine in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where many child labourers are toiling. Hannah Wandel presents his report.
We're in a mine in the North Kivu region, in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where coltan is extracted, an ore used in the production of mobile telephones, DVD players and computers. It's in great demand, but extracting it is hard work. Even adults suffer from the poor working conditions, but there are also plenty of kids working in the mines. One of them is 12-year-old orphan John.
I work in the mine to earn money for school and to pay for clothes. My father was killed during the war. Now I live with my uncle. He lets me work in the mine. If I didn't work here, I wouldn't be able to pay for food and other things, so I have to do it.
John, whose name has been changed for this story, lives near the mine, where he goes to work after school. He has asked child rights organisations to pay his school fees and those of other kids so that they can give up their jobs. Extreme poverty forces many children to take on adult roles and earn money for themselves and their families, like 15-year-old Richard. His father is paralysed, so if he wants to eat, the onus is on him to find the means to buy food. He tries to get work in the mine every day, but often returns home without a job.
I don't know anyone who owns a mine here, but sometimes people give me work because they feel sorry for me. If I don't earn enough money to pay my school fees, I have to write to the school principal and explain when I'll bring the money. If I don't pay, I'll be thrown out.
Although officially child labour is prohibited in the DRC, it is widespread. Many children have no other option than to work in the mines. Mine supervisor Bazinga Kabano is aware of this, but says it's hard to do anything about it.
We can't permit children to work here. It's against the law. But they slip in here without us noticing. They break the law because they don't have enough money for their school fees. We ask the children not to come here and demand the parents to tell their children that they are not allowed here.
Children's rights groups are also trying to prevent child labour in this area. Alexi Dahimana is chairman of a citizens' committee which deals with child rights.
We visit different organizations and look at ways of working together to liberate children from this slavery. Building schools is one way to help them out of the mines.
The government of North Kivu has come under attack for not doing enough to help stop child exploitation in the mines and elsewhere. But Deputy Governor of the region, Fale Lutai Kiva, says authorities are doing what they can.
The ore is found in many places, which people have discovered by themselves. They end up extracting them by themselves, too. Sometimes the kids are forced to do that. We encourage children to go to school so that they can get help from the government, their families, and from the schools themselves. We do it to help equip them for their future and so that they don't have to work as children. That's the government's goal.
But there's still a long way to go in order to achieve that goal. Just recently, the United Nations Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, MINUSCO, announced the discovery of new mines in the north of the country. If the current situation is anything to go by, it's only a matter of time before they'll be filled with children, toiling to earn their daily bread. The names of all the children in this report have been changed to protect them. Hannah Wandel, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about a woman in Berlin who's been labelled the hate destroyer. But first, here's some development news presented by Sue Cox.
Amnesty report details alleged crimes committed in Syria. A new Amnesty International report lists what it says are crimes against humanity committed by Syrian security forces during the country's violent crackdown on pro-democracy activists. The rights group urged the UN Security Council to refer Syrian forces to the International Criminal Court, impose an arms embargo and an asset freeze on President Bashar al-Assad and his aides. On May 15th, the Syrian army shelled the village of Tel Kalah, killing scores of people, arresting and torturing others. The 24-page report speaks of shots being fired at ambulances, children being detained and the wounded being tortured on their arrival at the hospital. Afghan official wants to tap into country's resources. Afghanistan's mines minister has announced a plan to develop a wide-reaching rail network in the Central Asian country to support the development of the mining industry there, despite ongoing combat operations against the Taliban and other insurgent groups. With the nation impoverished by more than three decades of war, the government hopes that it can kickstart its economy through Afghanistan's rich mineral deposits of iron and copper, which it claims are worth some $3 trillion, or 2 trillion euros. Critics say the security situation in Afghanistan is still too dangerous to bring in serious industry, making the project new targets for insurgents. But Chinese and Indian companies have already set up contracts to mine in the country. Big goals in the Ethiopian budget. Ethiopia's government has approved a record $13.5 billion or 9.3 billion euro budget for the next fiscal year, a large part of which should go to bolstering domestic health, education and infrastructure. The Horn of Africa nation is one of the fastest developing countries, with an average annual growth of 11% over the past 5 years, according to the government. The budget increase isn't only going to development resources, though. The Ethiopian military is also seeing a 50% hike in spending. Europe sends aid to North Korea. The European Commission announced on Monday it would give 10 million euros of food aid to North Korea, despite opposition from South Korea and US doubts over North Korea's pleas for help. The impoverished communist regime has asked dozens of countries and organizations around the world for aid, complaining that bad weather, rising global food prices, and the termination of aid from the principal donors South Korea and the United States had slashed supplies. The European Commission said it expects the aid will contribute to saving the lives of 650,000 North Koreans.
That was Sue Cox with the development news. The struggle for an independent state in Western Sahara is one of the world's forgotten conflicts. The Western Sahara, bordering Morocco, Algeria, Mauritania and the Atlantic Ocean, was a Spanish colony until 1975. Then the territory was occupied by Morocco. Since then, the Sahrawi Liberation Movement, Polisario Front, has been fighting for an independent Sahrawi state. Morocco currently controls two-thirds of the Western Sahara, including the entire Atlantic coastline and all major cities and natural resources. Yet more than 300,000 of the estimated 500,000 Sahrawi live in refugee camps near Tindouf in neighboring Algeria, where Polisario has its headquarters. The Moroccan-controlled territory and the refugee camps in Algeria are separated by a huge mined earth wall. And despite the fact that the UN has recognized the Polisario Front as the representatives of the Sahrawi people, the situation remains in a deadlock. Last month, for the first time, a group of politicians of the German Parliamentarians' Human Rights Committee visited the region. Steffen Marquardt talked to them after their visit.
The members of the Human Rights Commission of the German Parliament were all interested in the humanitarian situation of Sahrawis, both in the Moroccan-occupied territory as well as those living in refugee camps in Algeria. Heike Hensel from the oppositional left party, Die Linke, summarizes her impressions.
I have to say, I really can believe that the people are exhausted, that they are tired, the Sahrawis and the refugees, and that they are really waiting for political resolution of this conflict. More than 35 years, they have to live in these camps in the desert, and in my opinion, the living conditions are unacceptable at all. And we have to find a solution, and therefore we need more pressure on the Moroccan government and the king in order to really fulfill the UN resolution.
In the refugee camps near the Algerian city of Tindouf, the German parliamentarians met people who had been arrested by Moroccan forces. For years, nobody knew where they were, Frank Heinrich of the governing Christian Democrats recalls.
Some couldn't use their arms because the arm was just beaten to pieces. And we saw burnt wounds and heard stories of people that were tortured. In meeting these people, we know the eyes and the faces of the people, not just the lists of 200 that are not known where they are now, but of people that we've met that have been away for 7 years, 14 years, and so on. So we had some elements that show exactly that there are human rights violations. And we know that in a war situation, you have them sometimes on both sides.
The four huge refugee camps in Algeria near the city of Tindouf are named after towns located in the Western Sahara occupied by Morocco. Heike Hensel was impressed to see how well the Sahrawi refugee parliament and administration work there. The number of children attending school has risen from 10 to more than 90%.
They have a quite good social infrastructure. They have a good participation of women inside the parliament, inside their administration. And I was really astonished that they were quite successful by running these camps with the help of international community. And therefore, I'm sure after a referendum, they will be able to develop the Western Sahara.
When the German delegation returned to Morocco, it was a shock for Frank Heinrich to hear that some Moroccan parliamentarians likened the camps run by the Polisario to concentration camps. Such labels are offensive, Heinrich says.
Not an offense against the Polisario, because they are enemies, I can understand that. But against us, that coming from a history with concentration camps, not using that term without knowing exactly what we're talking about, but on the other side also, telling that MINURSO and UNHCR and all these humanitarian organizations would know that and don't tell. That's an offense against them and their work.
Other experiences reminded Frank Heinrich of dictatorships behind the Iron Curtain 30 years ago. Walking in a town, they were followed undercover by policemen. Or when people recognized that they were talking to Germans, they looked over their shoulders to be sure not to be watched. And more ill feelings arose when Heinrich saw the 2,700-kilometer-long earthen wall that divides the Western Sahara between the Sahrawi part and the Moroccan-occupied part.
Some of us weren't known about that long wall. Now, if we hear as Germans wall, we react. And for me, as a person that was born and brought up in the West, and now having a constituency in the East, that hurts. Just hearing of walls like in Palestine or in Israel, in this country, or in North Korea.
The Undersecretary of State of the German Development Ministry, Gudrun Kopp, returned from an official visit to Morocco 2 weeks ago. In a press statement on the ministry's homepage, she praises the good economic relation between Germany and Morocco and Morocco's reforms.
We see Morocco as a reform-oriented, reliable, and stable partner. Now all the announced reforms have to be really implemented. People are committed to developing more democracy, rule of law, a stronger role of the civil society. This deserves great respect and our political support.
Heike Hensel is disappointed that the German government representative did not even mention the Western Sahara issue in her statement. She also can't understand why the German government agreed to the renewal of the EU-Moroccan fishery agreement last week.
I think this is not according to international law, since there's also part of West Sahara inside this agreement, and the Sahrawis do not profit at all from this agreement.
Instead, it's mainly Morocco and Spain that are fishing in Western Saharan waters and making profits. And several European countries are interested in exploiting phosphate and other natural resources in the occupied territory controlled by Morocco. Heinrich is of the opinion that there are too many parties with economic interests in the troubled region, making the situation worse. A referendum deciding the status of Western Sahara has been proposed by the UN for several decades, but the Polisario and Morocco accuse each other of blocking the referendum. In the meantime, Heinrich fears Morocco is imposing its influence too much already.
It must not be by purpose, but it happens to be that way. And my feeling from this trip is that it looks like there is no solution. If not, the UN or the European Union take the subjects higher, as they have been doing.
Steffen Marquardt, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And in our last report today, we'll meet a woman who's been dubbed the hate destroyer. German far-right groups promote their racist ideology through stickers, posters and hate graffiti, like spray-painted slogans such as "Foreigners Out". But 65-year-old Irmela Menzer-Schramm is a very determined opponent of far-right extremism in Germany. Armed with oven scrapers, nail polish remover, water and a can of paint, Schramm has made it her mission to rid the streets of Berlin of this kind of hate graffiti. Cinnamon Nippert has more from Berlin.
Hier geht schon los. Da ist schon einer.
Okay, so here we go. This is the first one. This one was for the 17th of July. I took this one off like this because I knew that it was a fresh one. It says, National Union Fight, 17th of July, 1953. Today, like then, people are fighting for their rights and their freedom. NW-Berlin.net. It says National Resistance, but it's a cooperation with the Young National Democrats.
The National Democratic Party, or NPD, is Germany's far-right political party. They produce stickers and posters, like the one 65-year-old Irmela Menzer-Schramm just ripped off a drainpipe. We're on a street in Lichtenberg, a suburb in Berlin's east, known for its far-right activity. She carries a white cloth bag with her cleaning tools in it and looks for stickers on things like telegraph poles, traffic lights, the backs of street signs and telephone booths. Some people say that Schramm's actions infringe on freedom of speech, but she disagrees.
Meinungsfreiheit hat Grenzen.
Freedom of expression has limits. It ends where hatred and contempt for mankind begins. And with me, there are no ifs or buts, so no compromise.
Wenn und aber, also kein Kompromiss.
25 years ago, on her way to work, Irmela Menzer-Schramm saw a Nazi sticker that proclaimed freedom for Rudolf Hess. She thought about it all day, and on her way home that night, Schramm took out her keys and scratched the sticker off. Instantly, she felt better, and from that moment on, made it her mission to eliminate racist, homophobic and fascist graffiti and stickers.
Jeder Mensch kann was tun, und wenn man selber nichts tut...
Every human can do something, and if you don't do anything yourself, you can't change anything. If you just tolerate something like this, well, I think if you keep silent, you are complicit. And I just don't want to be complicit when the social climate is tainted by hatred.
In the last 4 years alone, Schramm has removed 39,000 stickers and posters, as well as painting over hate slogans sprayed on walls. She spends 100 hours and 300 euros every month on materials to destroy the offending graffiti. Schramm also documents her work by taking photos of the graffiti, as well as recording the date and its location. She made this into an exhibition called Hate, Photographed and Destroyed. But not everyone agrees with Schramm's course of action. Some people think she's just damaging property. And of course the NPD and other far-right groups don't take kindly to their propaganda being scraped off. Schramm recalls one time she was removing stickers from poles.
Ich mach die ab. Hinter mir Neonazi.
I'm taking them off. Behind me there's a neo-Nazi who keeps putting on new stickers. I remove them, he replaces them, and after the third round of removing them, I said, you know what, this is getting too silly for my liking. Then I took my mobile and I called the police and I said, in front of me there's a neo-Nazi who is constantly placing new stickers and I'm asking you to please come here. I would like to report this.
Und ich bitte, dass Sie kommen. Ich möchte es anzeigen.
The police officer asked for her address, and incredulous, she asked whether she should just give the neo-Nazi the keys to her apartment. The guy ran away while she was on the phone, and soon the police appeared, but they seemed unconcerned about the presence of far-right stickers and symbols on their beat. The police have often said to Schramm that these people don't know what they're writing. This kind of comment infuriates her.
I've written to every state office of criminal investigation all over the Federal Republic of Germany, and I asked whether the police is obliged to remove the things themselves or to arrange the removal and police it, and I received either different answers or they didn't give me an answer at all.
Sometimes when people notice what Schramm is doing, they help her and thank her. Just down from Lichtenberg train station, right outside the door to a cafe, Schramm spots a fascist sticker and starts peeling it off. A heavily tattooed and muscled young man looks over and asks what's going on. Schramm tells him she's removing a Nazi sticker.
Oh, okay, in that case, take it off. Are you doing this all day, taking off Nazi stickers? You'll still have a long way to go today.
Two Italian filmmakers were so touched by Schramm's work that they asked her if they could make a film about her. Fabrizio Lussu and Vincenzo Caruso follow Schramm and two other people, Kevin, a 24-year-old ex-neo-Nazi, and Lothar, a former soldier in the former GDR National People's Army. These three people fight against fascism in their daily lives. Caruso calls them heroes.
People need this kind of person, and also it's important that people understand that it's simple to become a hero, yeah. Like Irmala, like Lothar, like Kevin.
They have no superpowers.
No.
They are simple persons. So maybe the only things that different them from the other is the fact that they act.
Caruso hopes that the film will show people that everyone can make a difference.
Irmala says a very important thing. She says that it's possible to clean a wall, but it's not possible to clean the dignity of the people that this kind of graffiti hurt.
Since January, the trailer of Caruso and Lussu's film has been watched almost 80,000 times by people all over the world, from Mozambique to Greenland. Schramm says it's really helped people understand what she does and why she does it. Unfortunately, the neo-Nazis also know who Schramm is and sometimes spray paint threats to her on walls. Even though this makes her nervous, she says it also makes her more determined than ever to rid the streets of hate. Schramm holds anti-fascist workshops in schools and has been recognised with two awards for her work. Cinnamon Nippard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And that brings us to the end of this week's programme. Please do tune in again next week at the same time. And remember, if you ever miss a show, you can listen to it online at www.dw-world.de/development. On behalf of the production team today, I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn saying thanks for listening and goodbye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.